Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Making Music, and it is about how making one's own instruments or making instruments changes how one thinks about music, about how playing music. And for this episode are some folks who actually know a little bit about both making music in the performative sense and making music in the hardware sense. And if you can introduce yourselves and explain where we are, because we are on the road. This is an on-the-road podcast. From a remote location that'll be now disclosed.
We're in Acoustic Music Works, a fine stringed instrument store in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. My name's Raymond Morin, and I'm the luthier or instrument maker and repairman for this shop. I'm also the store manager for the shop.
My name's Adam Rousseau. I'm sort of the luthier's apprentice, if you will, and also work in the store occasionally.
Okay, so this podcast is already, for me, starting off on a bad note. Because I didn't know the word. Like, we're talking about this, and part of my job as host is to seem, you know, all educated and shit, and, you know, engaged. I didn't know that word was a word. Luthier?
Luthier, yeah.
Luthier,
Neither did my mom until yesterday.
Oh, really? Yeah, and that's, like, what you do?
Well, I've been doing it for, like, 3 years.
Yeah, I don't know if my mom knows what I do. But yeah, so I didn't actually know that word. So now I'm truly, having
it's
a...
it's from the old school for lute maker. And it kind of became common parlance for any stringed instrument maker or repair person.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
Luthery, is that the...
Yeah, luthery is the practice. And okay. it's kind of squishy, you know. It's violins, it's guitars, it's ukuleles. Like I said, it's not only building, but if you're a repair person for stringed instruments, you'd also be considered a luthier.
Yeah, and so how does one get into... Adam, you said you were an apprentice. I mean, is there a formal, like, luthier guild, or...?
There is. Adam's apprenticeship isn't formalized or official. He hasn't paid me any dues. He's paying his dues in the form of sawdust, certainly. But it's just something that it's something anybody can endeavor to do, and there is a guild called the Guild of American Luthiers that many stringed instrument builders belong to, including myself, which is in its way kind of informal. You pay dues every year, and you get subscription to their publications, and you get discounts on things they offer, like published plans and materials and things like that. But it doesn't come with any official gravitas. Like, somebody comes in and I say, I'm a member of the Guild of American Luthiers. They say, so what? You paid your $60.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're any good.
Yeah, and so you don't like it to, you know... I say this as a... I actually came from a union meeting to come here. So you don't like kneecap scabs or anything?
No.
Not like scab luthiers? And...
No. Not yet.
Not yet?
Not yet.
I guess thinking about the shop itself, and I've been here a couple times for like shows and stuff, and a couple times friends from out of town who are musicians. I remember one time we went to the Records of Jerry's, and which is right next door. For those of you listening in Pittsburgh and know where Jerry's is, and you now know where Acoustic Music Works is, and it was like Uke sale. They're like, "There's a Uke sale. We can go there," you know. And so you do have there are brands that you sell.
Yeah, right? we can break this on your podcast. There's always a Uke sale.
There's always a Uke sale.
There's never not a Uke sale.
Oh, I'm totally putting that in the tag.
But those words do bring people into the shop.
Yes,
who otherwise might not stop in. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and so, and I guess, you know, we could talk about how, you know, this sort of new economy that's coming, you know, sort of like, is this like, make the, you know, the analogy sort of like craft beer. You know what I mean? Like, there's, I guess if you just want a plastic shiny thing that makes noise, there's a chain store that shall not be named where everybody is. What did you say once, Adam? Everybody's just doing bad AC/DC.
Oh, a Guitar Center. Oh,
yeah, that place. Right. I mean, there's that. I mean, there is Budweiser is out there for that.
Why can you say Budweiser but not Guitar Center?
Well, because it's a competing business. You know, if people are idiots, they'll just come here and they won't know about that other place.
No, I now you've ruined it. The people that come here aren't idiots, actually. I think they're very smart and...
But, I mean, you get the occasional idiot who then just, you know, have money.
We love our customers. Yes. I hate that you're insinuating that.
No, I'm not insinuating. I'm just saying if somebody comes in with an American Express Black card and says, I want to learn how to play.
Wait, somebody can walk in here. We're not so exclusive they can't walk in here and ask any old question on your mind about any musical instrument that we are knowledgeable about, all the way down to a $40 ukulele and all the way up to a $20,000 guitar, you know, we don't purport to know anything about violins or saxophones or anything
oboes is not an oboe.
No oboes. But the stuff that we do carry, steel string acoustic guitars, banjos, mandolins, ukuleles, we know all those very intimately.
So
that's kind of the difference. If you go to one of the chain stores, They're not going to carry the brands that we carry because they're kind of more exclusive and they won't open those corporate stores. But the people that work at those stores don't have the luxury of just talking about the best of the best and the really well-crafted stuff. They have to talk about everything down to the, you know, the little starter pack that they're trying to sell you for Christmas. They're working on a commission. You know, I'm not working on a commission. I just want to get the best instrument the right instrument in the right person's hands, you know?
Yeah. So I guess then too, do you see it as like a stewardship, like what you're doing here, as far as like keeping maybe a tradition or a knowledge base alive?
There's not, I mean, I can't say that I'm contributing greatly to that, but I'm certainly part of it. Yeah. You know, we,
or at least maybe alive for this region or this neighborhood.
Yeah,
or...
there's nowhere else in this this city, certainly, but we joke that we're Cleveland's high-end guitar store, you know.
Ooh, like, talking smack.
No, but, you know, like every weekend, and Adam's here a lot of Saturdays, you know, somebody will come in from Columbus or Cleveland or Toronto or Washington, D.C. People will drive here 4 or 6 hours with no intention of even leaving with a guitar. They're just like, there's no one else within 6 hours of me that has the kind of inventory you guys have and carries the quality that you guys carry. So that's every weekend, essentially.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
And sometimes they overlap. These guys don't tell each other they're coming, so we'll be running around, you know, servicing 4 or 5 potentially, you know, big spending customers, you know, and running, you know, dozens of guitars in the course of a day off of the shelves in the back and off of the walls here and making sure they're all in tune. And it's all tailored to whatever that person, the idea they came in with. I'm thinking this brand or this style and you try and blow their minds, of course, when they come that far. You try and make sure they remember and that you really wowed them.
And that it's worth the trip.
Right.
And so, again, me being a sort of novice, I mean, I have, one of those, I think it was bought on Amazon, 4-string bass. I think I can get through at least a few bars of Mary Has a Little Lamb. That's my ability to play.
On a bass.
On a bass, yeah. Anyway, and my fingers hurt after. Yeah, you know what I mean? That's where I'm at, you know. I'm trying to get to Sid Vicious. You know, so when it comes to then, you know, this...
Nancy had a little lamb.
Yeah? Yes. When it comes to the sort of, you know, people's sound or people's aesthetic or what all goes into that decision-making process? As someone who, like, guitars are cool. That's where I'm at. Guitars sound cool. That's what I got. As opposed to, you know, thinking about it in these different, you know, I want this kind of guitar to make this... sound like, what goes into that decision-making process for someone who comes in here? And I'm sure, again, yeah, you're right, these people aren't dumb. They are here because it's a destination.
Usually they're here after extensive internet research, like extensive personal research into the brands, what people are saying about them. There's all these forums online. There's like general mandolin and guitar forums that there's thousands and thousands of members contributing conversations to. And then there's brand specific ones like Callings Guitars out of Austin, Texas is our biggest brand here. And to give you some perspective, Collings makes they make acoustic guitars, electric guitars, mandolins, and ukuleles, but they make about between 1,500 and 1,600 acoustic guitars in a year, versus a company like Martin or Taylor, which everybody's heard those names, are making over 100,000 each.
Wow.
So that's how kind of much smaller this niche is. So if somebody just walks in and says, I like guitars, the next thing they'd say is, but I like cars too, and these cost as much as cars.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, like, to come in here and expect to have a realistic shopping experience, you kind of have to take that next step and be like, okay, you know, I'm kind of not interested in the big factory brands that you can get at the chain stores. And, you know, we joke that a lot of people come here after they've outgrown those brands, you know. And the difference being is that the big guitar brands that like Martin, Taylor, Gibson, two of those brands have storied histories that the general consensus is they're well beyond their golden years. You know, like a brand, like a company like Martin, everybody thinks they made their best guitars before the end of World War II.
Wow.
So most of the builders that we represent are from a generation, like, several decades later. You know, a lot of these guys like Bill Collings and Dana Bourgeois started building guitars in the late 70s, where at that point those companies were so past their prime, they were overbuilding their guitars. And an acoustic guitar is something that you kind of have to walk this razor's edge. You want to build it lightly enough that it will respond very, very quickly. You know, do these very, very tight tolerances. You want to have really, really thin plates and really thin bracing. But the thing needs to be structurally sound so it won't blow up. It's going to be under a lot of string tension. And it's this razor's edge that you have to walk. And by the 70s, a company like Martin, to kind of stave off warranty repairs, was building their guitars so heavily that everybody now agrees that those were the dark years, and we don't ever want to build guitars like that again, at least not ones that we want, that we like the sound of. You can build a guitar like a tank and it'll last forever, but it won't sound as good as a lightly built guitar.
Oh, wow. So even then, I guess, is it come down to, you know, there's always that story about, you know, you think about wood, you know, Ted Williams would actually pick out the trees that he wanted his bats to be made out of. I mean, you know, and thinking about, well, this piece of wood, this grain, I mean, right. Is it even like down the stuff like the grain?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, stuff? Definitely. Yeah. Some guys and girls who are really maniacal about details and about their perceptions of what makes a good guitar count the grain lines, like in an inch on, say, a spruce top. They'll say like, oh, well, you know, I see it gets wider here, and I see it has summer growth here and winter growth here. And the difference, I'd say, versus the point that you brought up, is that what we come up against pretty often is what the customer thinks makes a good guitar, and how that relates to what the luthier and the shop owner or salesperson or knows makes a good guitar. So it's a weird thing. Like, somebody will come in and they'll say, well, it has to be Adirondack spruce. It has to be this very certain kind of very stiff spruce. Well, how do you play? You know, and if they tell me that they play very, very gingerly, very lightly with the tips of their nails, with the flesh of their fingers, I'm going to say, why do you want such a stiff spruce that is so takes so much energy to get moving? You know, wow. I'd say, why don't you want a cedar or an Engelmann spruce or a Sitka spruce, something that'll be more easily excited, you know, because Adirondack spruce, again, back to the Martin and the kind of pre-war style of building, that's all they built with back then, and those guitars are generally considered some of the best sounding guitars ever made. So everybody says, well, I want Adirondack spruce because that's the best. It's like, sure, historically it's very highly regarded, but it doesn't mean it's right for you. So those are the kind of conversations we have.
Oh, wow. That's
all that stuff. Adam and I, as guitar builders, those are the decisions we make when we set out to make a guitar. It's like, well, we're doing this size. What materials will create the voice that we want materials and size for this particular instrument.
Wow, that's incredible. So I guess then the next thing, thinking about, okay, so you're active building. How does that then change the way that you play, or do you then even within the store, you know? And I'm sure if you're sort of a gear centric person, right? For this kind of playing, I'm going to pick up one of these, or I'm making guitar for, you know, do you make guitars specifically for people?
Well, yeah, like we made a guitar for one of our friends, that was sort of the impetus for like me working with Raymond to begin with, was we decided we were going to make a guitar for one of our friends. And yeah, we picked out the woods like very kind of specifically for his playing and the body shape based on what, you know, the kind of guitars he liked in the past. And is that how he came to like the German top for?
Well, we picked the back and side woods, which in an acoustic guitar, in a traditional style flat top guitar, the back and sides woods aren't hugely influential to the overall sound when compared to the soundboard, the top wood. Mm-hmm. And the way it's braced. Mm-hmm. So for this particular guitar, we picked the back and side woods because they were just stunning, beautifully, mm-hmm. beautiful woods that were really striking looking. And we were building such a small box called a baby. It's a design that Bill Collings came up with. It's almost essentially a 3/4 size guitar, mm-hmm. which. The reason we wanted to build this guitar for our friend is that he's, as Adam and I are, this fans of this musician named Milo Jones, and that was kind of his guitar of choice. Mm. Because it's so small, there's really low tension on the strings, and you can get these like just kind of very dynamic things like these, like you can get these big chord stretches because it's a really short scale. You can do these like crazy. Milo does this crazy full chord vibrato, which on a full size guitar with full tension would just be too physically challenging. Oh. But on this little baby guitar, you can do these little. It has its own character, you know. Even though it's for a grown person, it's a small guitar. Mm. It still has a kind of a novel element to playing it, and I knew that he wanted that. You know, one day he'd like to have one of these kind of guitars, and we said, well, heck, we're going to build him a guitar. Let's make him something that's just going to, like, be totally different than anything he's had and something that he has always kind of wanted. So we chose the back and side woods just for their looks, but the top wood, we chose a German, like a European spruce top as a kind of stiff-ish top that would have a complex kind of sound. And we and he were really happy with the way that guitar turned out.
Yeah. So, which is now leading me also to think about doing this and having this knowledge base, I mean, how does it change as you listen to music? I mean, can you, you know, when you hear someone play or if you go to a show or something, I mean, do you find yourself sort of eyeing up like their gear and thinking kind of critically about, well, you know, well,
you, always, that you always sound better. The gear more for kind of like where's their head at, like, and how. But at a show, as far as acoustic instruments, you almost never hear the instrument acoustically represented in a fair way. That's why, you know, most working musicians put a pickup in their acoustic guitar, and there isn't an acoustic pickup that sounds like an acoustic guitar. It really brings it way into the realm of electricity, and some sound much better than others, and some you can kind of convince yourself that it has a quote-unquote natural feel. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, it's like the store owner here is named Steve Miklas. He always says, you know, take the Eagles. They can play any guitar they want. They're rich guys, and they own wonderful, amazing acoustic guitars, but what do they walk out on stage and play? You know, $1,000 Takaminis because it's plugged in. Who can tell the difference in the audience? Like Adam and I, we might fuss about it for a split second in our own minds, but we'd never have a serious discussion about somebody's acoustic tone at a show, because it's really neither here nor there. On a recording, it's a different kind of thing.
Yeah,
you can really hear some of the nuances. So, but, you know, it certainly changes, you know, to your earlier point, you know, it's certainly, you pick up a certain guitar and it does inspire you to make certain moves and to hit it a certain way.
Wow, that's fascinating. Because I know, yeah, I mean, and I know people get sort of obsessive. I remember reading something about, like, say, Elliott Smith. He had 10 kinds of the same guitar. Mm-hmm. Or I think he had 20 guitars. He had 10 of one kind, 10 of another.
Yeah.
And that was it.
And a high, you know, a finely made guitar, there's two tiers of it. You know, there's the high production factory model like Martin or Gibson, mm-hmm. where, sure, 10 guitars, especially built over a variety of years, even if they're the same shape, are going to have an appreciably different sound. Mm-hmm. You know, but then on a really, really highly crafted guitar, built to really, really high standards of excellence, you're going to hear every nuance in that piece of wood, guitar to guitar. You know, so any little change, we here at the shop, we have lots of customers who own multiple guitars, and it is like that sometimes. They'll have 6, 7, 8 of the same shape, but they'll do all these different combinations of woods. They'll change the scale length. They'll do cosmetic changes just to kind of change it up. Mm-hmm. Some of the different models, you can get different body depths, and that has a pretty profound effect on the sound.
And so there are certain, like, luthiers who are, like, you know, like the Stradivarius sort of thing, where you can say, well, that person makes, you know, or has, like, a stamp that they put on it.
Sure.
That's sort of personal.
Sure, yeah. I mean, luthiery is huge now. It's, you know, up until the 70s or 80s, there were no, obviously no internet, but there were no books on the subject. I think in the, turning from the 70s and the 80s, I think there was one book written on it. And then in the 80s, this guy Michael Cumpiano, or I'm sorry, William Cumpiano, wrote a book called Acoustic Guitar Design and Technology, I think that's what it's called. I have two copies of it. which kind of became the jumping off point for most builders since. And so now luthiery is pretty big. There's lots of people, because of the internet and because there's more supply houses available now and so much more information on the craft. There's just a lot more people endeavoring to do it. But the steel string acoustic guitar world in particular is very, very traditional. So anything you do to expand from tradition is at your peril in the marketplace, unless you can tell that story really, really well. You know, the guys that are really, really, the guys that go their own way and are really, really great at it, somebody like there's a luthier in California named Irvin Somogyi who has his own methodology and writes his own books and has his own techniques for voicing and everything. His guitars cost $20,000 and $30,000, which is way more than the tier of the stuff that we're selling. But his customer base is so much smaller, obviously, because you have to be pretty wealthy to invest in one of those guitars. Yeah. But his voice has gotten very specific and appeals to a very specific kind of guitar player. Whereas the builders that we carry, and I'd probably even say the tradition that Adam and I work in, is more of the traditional Martin and Gibson school. We use a lot of the modern shop's more updated structural techniques. Like, we use modern glues. We don't use animal glues like the old pre-war guitars. We use a bolt-on neck joint. We don't use a glued-in dovetail joint. Kind of the more modern innovations of the Collings and the Bourgeois and the Huss and Dalton and these kind of guys, even Taylor and guys like that, have pushed the craft along to where our kind of aesthetic to an extent, and our construction methods and the shapes that we use are more or less traditional, but that's where we are. We one day, I think, want to design something completely different, but we don't want it to be form over function. Yeah. You know, it's got to still connect with you as an acoustic guitar and not some new fangled thing.
Yeah, so now this has me thinking about something I read actually in Adbusters a few years ago about the idea of, you know, the 20th century was the century of the sort of larger in life industrial production, and you know, it was the sort of the jet age, and you know, saying that perhaps, you know, the 21st century, and I see, you know, in what you're saying, and even, yeah, craft beer and all that stuff, that, you know, is the future actually going to be small, slow, and local? And is that part of, like, some kind of weird, like, maybe larger, like, social, like, sea change that's happening, that, you know, instead of going to that Guitar Center place and the mass guitar...
Nobody likes to go there.
Nobody likes to go there.
I mean, really, like, even if you're into the stuff that they carry, even if you're into Les Paul guitars and Stratocasters, like, nobody likes to go there. There's great stores like Pianos and Stuff here in Pittsburgh that actually carry that stuff, but are locally owned companies and their personalized experiences. It's not just about, like, hey, 30-day no questions asked return policy, like, which is just begging to be exploited, you know. It's, I know all the time, I see people on Facebook, somebody saying, hey, does anybody have a mixer I can borrow or something for the weekend? Somebody like, go buy one and just return it when you're done. You know, which is kind of crazy, but the companies that are churning out those products are huge corporate companies, so it's kind of...
So do they just not care? I mean, clearly they must have caught on to that people are doing that.
Well,
I mean, they must be doing it on a pretty large scale.
Guitar Center in particular, it's pretty well-documented failed model. You know, their amount of revenue right now, and this is all... There's great articles on the internet about this if anybody's interested, but their revenue now doesn't quite service the cost of their debt.
Ooh.
You know, they're one of those companies that was bought by Bain Capital at one point, like, to kind of, you know, save it or turn it around or whatever, and of course they got out of it as soon as they made their little bit of money, and so they're just a big brand that everybody recognizes, and there's a lot of places in this country that's the only music store, so... Yeah. You know, like, we have a really good customer here who lives in Columbus, and that Guitar Center is been open for a long time, and it's run by really good, knowledgeable guys, and he likes going there. He can't get the kind of stuff he gets here, there, but he goes there and gets the kind of stuff he likes from there, and it's fine, and I'm totally into that. The ones around here are, for my interests, like, pretty, you know... There's not really anything there to fulfill my interest. I, you know, obviously I don't end up going to a lot of other music stores being an acoustic guitar player. But if I wanted, you know, if I was in the market for a Stratocaster or something like that, I would be making the rounds to those places.
Yeah. A full disclosure, I got the mic that we're using from that place because free shipping if you get it delivered to the store, you know. There you go. But no, so I guess, too, you were talking about you had these really good customers. So I guess there's also sort of maybe a kind of intimacy to, you know, having repeat customers and knowing what people want and saying, hey, by the way.
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really... The store started about 14 years ago, and the relationships that even started in that first year, many of them are still ongoing.
More like clients than customers.
Yeah, it's like you're in friends even to a point. Like you've seen these people go in and out of such, like, fantastic instruments. Like, you're really... It's like anything else. Every time you sell a fine instrument to somebody... It's like Christmas Day for them. You're happy because you made that connection with the right instrument for the right person. And, of course, you know, it goes in the cash register and the store soldiers on. But with the weird thing is, a lot of people get into this upper tier of acoustic instruments saying, like, you know, this is it. I'm going to buy this one and it's going to be the lifetime guitar. Or lifetime mandolin. It's like, the reason I'm getting this is because I'm done looking. This is the one. And it never is. It never is. Like, once you've made that step where you say, like, You know, for a lot of people, it might be $500 or $1,000. But once you've actually spent $5,000 on a guitar, you can do it again. Because you're over the mental thing.
Yeah.
And once you realize how good a guitar can be, or a mandolin, whatever, you know, once you realize how good it can be and how many flavors there are at that tier, you just, most people can't stop at one flavor. They want to experience that again and again. They want to try, you know, a dreadnought, an orchestra model, and a double O, and a triple O, and a single O, and a parlor guitar. They, you know, most people don't own them all at once, but a lot of people cycle
through. And the interesting thing that I think is worth bringing up that we always kind of talk about is, like, the future of that market, of that audience, is that like the large percentage of these customers are baby boomers, right?
Yeah.
Who have money to spend on this.
And their heroes were James Taylor, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, a different generation of musicians that were identified with acoustic guitars. And the people that identify with acoustic guitars now, at least in the mainstream, like Mumford & Sons, stuff like that, they are not our heroes.
They went electric anyway, so.
Well.
Yeah.
Good riddance.
I guess so, for you guys, and you're talking about this, so the what really sort of sparked that passion in you? I mean, because I think as much as you're talking about, they got over the mental thing, you're all in. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, and you're getting in, Adam. In terms of what drives that for you guys to say, you know, I'm not just going to play. I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to go all in. I'm going to make this a life, maybe a lifestyle, or at least a profession, or an apprenticeship. You know, what for you guys drove the, you know, just not being satisfied with that, you know, $500 guitar, or, you know.
Well, for me, it was somewhere in between. Certainly, like. It wasn't that the cheap guitar didn't do what I needed it to do, but I used to be in a band, and we were on tour once, and we stopped in this famous shop in Nashville called Gruen Guitars, and I played a little 00 Gibson. It was called a Blues King, and I'd never played a little guitar like that. I'd always played the standard big dreadnought style, because that's what everybody had. So I played this, and I was like, ooh, this is, you know, different. And it kind of informed, like, because I was just starting to finger pick, and it kind of informed that sensibility, you know, oh, this is what all the old blues guys finger picked on. And so then when I got back home from that tour and started looking around for these, like, oh, well, I'm going to have to shell out $900,000 for this thing. And I did, and I loved it, and it served me well for a long time. And then when I wanted to change body style, because that style is kind of a narrow kind of voice of what it can do, I wanted to change to something a little bigger, but not quite as big as the dreadnoughts. I started looking for what's called an orchestra model. It's a really, really popular guitar shape. So I stayed in that tier and started going even a little higher and be like, well, I'm not going to go back to playing like Chinese-made stuff or whatever. I'm going to look for something nice and American made. And I just, you know, I'd become a man at that point and kind of could take pride in things like buying American manufacturing or buying something well crafted. And I was starting to get a little savvy about what things held their value and what features actually contributed to the sound versus what you were just paying for cosmetics or the looks or the name on the headstock. So then I got into that tier, which is kind of a middle range, you know, between $1,000 and $2,000, companies like Gibson and Larrivée. And then I moved to Pittsburgh and started coming in here. And so my instant sensibility was like, well, you know, what's the big deal? You know, why are these guitars so expensive and all this kind of... And so just through hanging out here, I got kind of an education in all that stuff. And when I... several years later, when I was much more interested in all this stuff, and it became kind of a foregone conclusion that I was going to come to work here, that's when I started telling myself, you know, I bet I'd be way better at this job if I knew how to build one. like if I knew them inside and out. And that is certainly proven to be true. But once you accomplish something like that, it's a funny thing. You know, you're just like, wow, I can't believe, like, I've been playing guitar for so long, and I can't believe I actually made a guitar that I can play, you know? And, but you make the one, and you're like, well, the next one, I know exactly, like, how I'll make it better. And of course, any craft, particularly any woodworking-related thing, it's going to be pretty rough the first few times out. Adam actually owns the first guitar that I made by myself. I made one before that at Luthier School. Mm. Adam owns the first one I made by myself. And I think within a few months of getting that, we came up with the idea to make this guitar as a gift for our friend. And I said, you know, do you want to... I'm learning this thing. I know a little bit more about it, but do you want to help me make a couple of guitars? And then you can really contribute to the guitar for our friend. And that's what happened. And then he just got into it.
Yeah, because he made that guitar for me. Because I had specifically asked him, I was like, when he first started getting into this, which I've been fascinated with it, like, since kind of day one, when I remember he came over to my apartment with, like, the very first bridge that he made, like, hand-carved in his basement.
Yeah.
And I still remember
before
that.
I was working here, you know, I was and like, I'm going to learn, and I was in the basement, like, just with hand tools. Yeah. Like, it took forever. Like, I probably spent 8 hours carving that bridge, which is a crazy amount of time. Now, we would never... We have methods. We wouldn't have to devote that much time now, but yeah, it was like I'm showing up at Adam's house and I'd be like,
yeah,
look.
And I was like, oh wow, it's amazing. And I remember you said, you were like, this is my thing now. This is what I'm going to do, is make guitars. And I don't know. It was just kind of amazing to me. And I, even before I started building, like, I would come to the shop and hang out and just watch what he was working on. And then, and I was like, well, yeah, you're going to have to build me one. I definitely want one of the first ones, you know, so I can have, like, you know, imagine having, like, one of the first Collings or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and then, like, before I knew it, it was done. And he was like, well, here it is. And I didn't have any concept on how long it took to build a guitar. Like, I assumed it took, like, years. Like, no clue. And before I knew it was done, he's like, well, here you go, like, you know, if you like it, like, we'll work out some, you know, payment thing. And I was like, oh, great. And, like, I at the time, I had no money to pay for the guitar because I didn't even know what it cost. And I think Raymond must have probably picked up on that because he was like, well, you know, why don't you start working with me and kind of pay off the guitar that way? I was like, that's a great idea. And so I started doing that. And you know, and also... because we wanted to make this guitar for our buddies as sort of a collaborative project. And that was, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. It's funny how...
Yeah, I think you'll be in it for 2 years this summer, officially.
Yeah, wow.
Which is kind of crazy because we think in terms of me being the full-time kind of guitar guy and Adam, like, when he can... but he's been working here, like, with me for the better part of when I've been here at this point. And it's kind of just now coming together in really interesting ways because we actually just were playing it before you got here. We did our first official, like, we've worked together on five or six guitars now. And but the one that's just about finished, we're going to deliver to a customer next week, is our first original shape. It's still a traditionally minded guitar. It's got a traditional voice. There's nothing funky or crazy about it. There's no way out ideas. But we designed the lines, you know. We decided how deep it was going to be, picked all the woods, obviously. And so we're kind of both, before you got here, having this first experience with, like, okay, so we've been working on this craft or whatever. Everything we've done, we've kind of compared to the comparable version from Collings or Martin or whatever. And this is the first thing we've made that really, we don't need to compare it, like, the experience of it to anything. We can certainly compare the craftsmanship to the better stuff, and we're not quite there, but it's not half bad, if I say so myself. but it really is this new kind of thing of like, well, you know, maybe we have something to say here too, you know. Yeah. Maybe it's not just, maybe you don't just follow the book or follow the tradition. Maybe you can, you know, definitely you can take that and run with it as an artist. And we're literally in the first moments of that part of the story, which is real exciting.
That is. And I want to go back to something you said, Adam, about the idea of, oh, it's got to take years to make a guitar or whatever. I mean, but I think, though, that also that there is that sort of sacred quality of music. You know, at least like within the Western tradition, you know, there were, you know, kingdoms that only allowed, you know, liturgical music because there was this thought that, you know, you were somehow tapping into this kind of supernatural power.
Yeah,
you know, which is sort
like
of, you know,
religions banning certain notes in the scale and all that stuff. It's super interesting.
Yeah.
And the fact that different cultures use different scales.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and there's almost then this kind of like, you know, man behind the curtain kind of priesthood maybe to what you're doing, in that, you know, yeah, it is this matter of creativity in that sort of almost metaphysical sense, right? In terms of thinking about, you know, we've taken this thing that maybe, you know, people put on a pedestal, right? A really good guitar, and you kind of know its guts. Which it puts you maybe in also a kind of an interesting position in terms of thinking about, you know.
Well, that's what I thought of when you said, does making instruments affect the way you hear music or go to a live show and experience it? And it's not so much compared to, say, when you know how to play, like Adam and I are both guitarists. When you become a functioning guitar player or fairly proficient guitar player, that affects it way more because the old cliche kicks in of, well, I could do that. You know, at least with the guitar building, we know that not every guy at the show is thinking, well, I could have built that thing he's playing, you know. but you definitely, when you pick up a guitar, you certainly have that thought.
So Adam, and so you're in an electric rock band. Has this process changed, like, how you compose or create in that sense?
I think it's changed a little bit of my writing just from kind of being around, you know, these instruments and the sort of being introduced to, well, specifically kind of through the shows that happen here, which are all acoustic shows pretty much, and watching a lot of the players. Like, I think it's sort of changed my approach to writing. Like, I've been trying to do more like sort of finger style stuff, and I guess a little bit what I really was sort of drawn to and continue to be attracted to as far as the guitar making is that, like, it's sort of a complete opposite approach to how I play music. Like, playing music for me and making art in general, like painting or playing guitar, like I'm kind of very sloppy about how I approach it, and it's always like just like kind of get the main idea across, like, however that happens, and, you know, it can be kind of haphazard, and, you know, sometimes much to my bandmates' chagrin.
You don't
want
the craft of it to overshadow the inspiration and the kind of emotion of the idea, whereas with making a guitar, you can't have that.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't say, like, yeah, sure, it doesn't look good, but I had an awesome time making it.
Yeah,
yeah. The customer's going to be like, I don't care. I want it to be good.
Like, with making a guitar, like, if you're off on something by a 64th of an inch, like, the whole thing could be all out of whack, you know? And it's just, it's been a very interesting mental exercise, at least for me, to sort of, it's a completely different way of thinking and working, which I feel like has been very, very good for me to sort of have to focus a lot more in a completely different way. And, but at the same time, it's all about music at the end of the day. So it's sort of like approaching music from completely different angles. Like, I come make guitars one night, and then the next night I have band practice. So it's like the whole thing, you know.
In the first few weeks of making guitar, you're kind of picking the materials and just kind of starting to shape them. you're thinking a lot about how that guitar is going to sound and how it will feel to play that guitar. And then there's, typically for us, it takes us 4 or 5 months to make a guitar. And there's usually a couple going concurrently. Mm. But start to finish, it's maybe 4 or 5 months before one is out the door. But then there's this long period in the middle where you're not really thinking so much about how it sounds. You're just thinking about putting it together the correct way and making sure all the joinery is correct and all the work is clean. And then in the last few weeks, you start really thinking again. It's like, I'm going to get to play this pretty soon. We're going to finally hear it. You know, and then you start to kind of really start thinking about it all the time. Because you're... And that's... For me, when you really have to... really turn your craftsman focus on, because you can't rush through the last steps, you know, those last things like kind of you know, setting the neck angle and making the nut in the saddle, the things that the strings ride on, slotting those string slots and getting the frets the right height and shape and everything. All that stuff is going to affect the way the guitar plays forever. Mm. And you just, if you rush it, you blow the whole thing.
So, and I guess too, is it sort of like, I mean, this analogy is a cliche, but like a chess match where you have to, are you thinking 5 moves ahead at some, you know, at certain point?
Yeah, I mean, from the very first move, you're kind of making a commitment to get all the way to the very last move. Mm. You know, which... And invariably, there's challenges in the course of it where you're like, well, and you're always trying to build your bag of tricks and always trying to advance your process. So you might think something's going to go one way, and then it might take a slight turn, and you might have to solve a new problem. That happens all the time for new builders like us. Yes. The big shops have systems, you know. But once you have a system down, and you always just want to experiment, you want to go deeper into the unknown, you know. So you always say, well, now we know how to make X thing. How can we make it better? Like, how can we just make it? Like I was saying earlier, those tolerances. How can we make it tighter so the thing's lighter weight and the thing responds more quickly and all that. So yeah.
Cool. Cool. And I think so. On that note, it's now time for the bottom five.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. The bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready? Mm. You ready? All right. Question one, which I think actually, Adam, you've had this question before. So maybe this one's just for Raymond. This is the stock for question everybody gets.
Should I answer it again, then we compare it to my old answer?
Oh, yes, you could, yes.
See if I've grown as a person.
Ah, there we go. I could do that. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be? Like, even that sort of, like, higher frame of being thing, like, you totally messed up, basically. And you have to go back to single-cell organism. And it was, like, some kind of virus or disease or something like that. What would but you got to pick. What virus or disease or sickness would you want to be?
I think I said the common cold last time.
Yeah.
I think I said because something like, it's, you know, it's really not that bad.
Yeah.
But it's incurable, so it'll be around forever. So
yeah, there you go. Eternity.
Made your mark. I think I'd want to be, like, not a disease so much as maybe a condition.
Okay.
Like something that could have a positive, like freckles or something.
Oh, okay, freckles. That's good. Yeah, I like that.
I don't know if that's... You got to pick a disease, right? No?
Well, I'll let it slide. All right.
But something freckles. Like that. Something like... I mean, freckles is a condition. It's a genetic thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something like a... Something that could have, like, a positive... Like, could also potentially make someone happy.
Well, I could...
Like, I could say gangrene, you know, yeah, you might create an amputee, and somebody might think that's hot some more.
Yeah. I had a student this semester, or this last semester, who was going to the music school, and she has that condition where she can see music.
What does that mean?
Like, she lives, certain sounds are visualized for her.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, one person I heard, you know, had, you know, like, a bass sound is just a black box that pulsates that they see floating in space.
Isn't that sort of like a symptom of autism, too, where their senses kind of get crossed?
Kind of get crossed, yeah. But she does it, and she, you know, has already been playing with the symphony and stuff, and I thought, like, that would be cool. All right. Question two, and I'm saying this in a place where there are power tools. What is the strangest injury you have ever suffered?
I don't really get injured that often. Knock on wood. Strangest injury.
And I think in terms of like maybe the circumstances that are, how does anybody do this? I once stapled my own hand.
You go.
Broken nails are a pretty common thing. Broken fingernails, that is. Which it's always a case of a split second stupid thing that you didn't even try and do. Like last week I went to open my door and just jammed my thumbnail on the door and my nail cracked. And that affects my guitar playing until I can grow it back out or get it fixed, you know? So...
That's awful.
Those, they're not strange, but they're always so stupid, you know? They're always just the stupid things that have nothing to do with any risk you're taking or anything you're trying. You know, whenever we leave, Adam picks me up to come to work at the shop, and my wife, Manette, will say, "Don't lose a finger." And it's kind of like, we won't leave until she says it. Because it's kind of like this good luck kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, like, we'll leave, and it's like, don't you have something you want to say to us?
Yeah, well, I mean, it worked out for Tony Iommi, so.
Yeah. But he, you know, he had a strong northern constitution. He would have been all right no matter what.
Yeah. Supposedly, I saw a thing where actually that day he went home for lunch and he's like, "I'm not going back." And his mom was like, "No, go back to work, finish your job." And that's when. Well, you know, Tony Iommi's missing like parts of three of the fingers.
He made fake fingertips.
Yeah, out of plastic bottle caps and stuff, yeah, and had to slack the strings. And that's where the Black Sabbath sound comes from. But he was working, right. It was his last day in a factory, and he got put on this metal press. Thing that would be like a giant chop saw, this blade would just come down and like cut pieces of metal, and he'd never worked on the machine before, and they're like, "It's your last day, screw it." And yeah, he went home for lunch and he's like, "I'm not going back there," and his mom's like, "You better go." And then he went back and chopped off, you know, of, yeah, it was top hand, three of the fingers. Wow. And then made plastic bottle cap fingertips and had to slack the strings, and the Black Sabbath sound was born. So I would say it'll be all right.
Glad that guy lost his fingers, man. He's probably glad he lost his fingers at this point.
Yeah.
It set events into motion that have been pleasing for all involved.
Yes. Yes, do you think about it also what that did for black t-shirt sales?
Adam didn't know who Dio was.
Rainbow
still kind of doesn't.
Oh, yeah. I remember we had this conversation, but...
Dio sang for Black Sabbath after they... Did they kick Ozzy out?
Yes, they kicked Ozzy out.
Yeah. I remember. Yeah.
And he was...
The Dio years, but he was also fronted Dio, the band, which is considered one of the classic...
And Tenacious D wrote, like, the song about it or something.
And he was also Rainbow and Elf. Sorry, I had a roommate in college.
He is an Elf. Or he was an Elf.
He was an Elf, yes. He's dead now, but... I had a roommate who, his CD collection, you could play... The Ronnie James Dio game, like the way people play the Kevin Bacon game, with his entire CD collection. That somebody was then briefly in this band with Ronnie James Dio.
That's how we used to.
Very bizarre.
When I was just out of high school, that's how we used to buy CDs. We were like hungry for new music, and we weren't listening to the radio. So with us, it was the touch and go, Thrill Jockey merge distribution catalog. You'd go through it, and it was like a print catalog. It came in every CD. It was folded up to CD size. And you'd look at every band. They would, at the end of the description of the album, it would say, "Features members of." And you'd just draw a line back to some band that you had already heard that you liked. And Yeah, we found all our favorite bands when I was 19 to 22. Mm. Pretty much all my favorite bands came from that exercise of reading that catalog.
I miss those. I miss those.
And having $60 a week to go and buy three CDs, you know.
Three, yeah.
Which is kind of I can't imagine now spending $60 a week on CDs.
Yeah. Yeah,
on one record.
Yeah. I miss those days of almost that deprivation too. Because now on the internet, you can just pull it up.
Well, yeah, you get a CD, and even if you didn't like it the first listen, you're like, well, damn it, I'm going to listen.
Yeah.
I'm going to listen. Because this was my CD. I got a CD this week. That's what I'm going to listen to.
Yeah. And then not knowing and the going to the record store and not finding what you wanted. Yeah. Whereas now, you know, I think our bargain and the way we experience music is just we know everything going in.
Remember when I learned the trick to detach the bottom thing of the bottom tab of the jewel case to get that sticker off cleanly?
Ah!
You know, on the cover of the jewel case? That was huge.
Yeah. It took you 20 minutes just to open
that. That made my CD collection look way more pro. And I had, like, this is, like, I had, like, when I had 75 CDs, I saw it as a collection. I was like, this is a solid catalog of music. This is well curated. Mm. And now it's, you know, it's just, we're post iPod even, you know.
Yeah.
It's like you don't have a collection anymore. Yeah. People have record collections.
I'm a dinosaur with both. Yeah, I'm a dinosaur with both. I mean, I went to college as an undergrad. I had 45 CDs and I left with around 300, and people go, oh, you have a lot of CDs, and I still have, I mean, I have a room in my new house. I mean, I have 3,000 CDs and probably about 4,000 records, and so I'm a total dinosaur with that. I don't Spotify. It's like, no, you must commit. You must commit.
You know, the whole reason we have CDs is the dinosaur poop, right?
Yeah. There we go. So it's circle of life. All right. Question 3. What is your most irrational pet peeve? The thing that makes you just redline angry, though, and really in the grand scheme of things, it shouldn't. Mm. Like, mine is, the classic one for me, is people who juxtapose the words itch and scratch. I had a scratch, so I itched it. I'll kill that person in front of their family.
How many have you killed now?
Well, you know, I keep moving.
You know, basically. I don't look back.
I keep moving.
At the person,
you know,
I might have just killed.
Yes. No. Yes. You know, they
to better times.
You don't want to. You don't want to hear those screams in your dreams. Let me tell you. But that's mine. I mean, I have actually a lot of them. And that's why I asked this guy. The other one is people who live in a metro area, but they say they live within the city limits.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
People who are from Mount Lebanon, who's like, I'm from Pittsburgh. No, you're not! You have a different mayor, and it's a different place. Own it! Own it, damn it! You know, I mean, I'll, you know, when I'm king, there's it's going to be a line of people against the wall.
It seemed kind of rational. Mine on the same lines, I think. Maybe you asked me this question before that I'm having just deja vu, is when people misuse the word ignorant.
Oh, which is only around Pittsburgh here. Dialect, yeah.
Is to use ignorant in place of the word rude, I guess. So they say, this person was ignorant to me.
Yes.
When they're really being ignorant of the meaning of the word ignorant.
Ignorant's not a verb.
It's just like my head just wants to explode every time I hear someone say that. And it's, yeah, that's got to be my biggest pet peeve.
I hate to come up with another disease-esque non-answer, but I think my... All right, I can come full circle with this. My lack of pet peeves, I think, frustrates my wife, because she's real detail-oriented, and she comes up with lots of little things. It's like, she's got the words. She doesn't like the word raw. She doesn't like the word bizarre. Like,
she doesn't like the word raw?
They give her the heebie-jeebies. Those words.
Wow.
Huh.
And I'll go on jags over it, you know.
In any context?
Yeah, like I'll put them all together. I'll be like, oh, so you don't like a raw, bizarre gash in a, you know, like I know all these little words that she doesn't like. But it probably bugs her that I don't have irrational pet peeves. I probably have peculiarities. Tell me a peculiarity of mine. You're around me pretty often.
Mm.
See?
I don't
totally
know.
Level. Yeah. Even Steven.
Even Steven, you know.
But I don't get shaken up like to the extent of wanting to kill somebody and their whole family. What did you say?
In front of their family. I think yeah. that's horror. You know, no. Maybe it is the monk-like quality of the work.
Yeah, yeah, like that stuff would, you know, I don't hang-ups in general. Mm. You know, they just.
I think I've seen you get pissed off exactly once, and it was the whole, I don't want to name any names, but the guitar building incident where you had to stop a build. I don't know if we could talk about that.
Yeah, well, I had a customer, sure.
I've never seen you get angry about anything until this.
Well, it was a growing experience, and it was me being reactionary. It certainly wasn't peevy. Mm-hmm. It was really kind of like a kind of weird emotional like thing where I had to cancel a build because I had a customer who insisted on like funneling money in for the build. Like usually a mm-hmm. customer pays a deposit up front, small deposit, and pays the balance off when the instrument's done. But you have some customers always, and it's true in the store as well as with guitar building, who for the sake of the household or the wife, you know, they're like, well, it's easy for me to like kind of like push a little money down your way like more regularly instead of having to pay most of it at once at the end. So you concede to this, you know, because you're like, of course, you know, if that's easier for you, that's fine with me. But I had a customer that had some kind of notion that that the money was going to be kept in a slush fund, even though I had told him every time he said, I'm going to send you another check, I would say, great, I'll buy a tool and your guitar will come out better because I'm going to improve my shop. Your money's going into materials and equipment and all that kind of stuff. So one day he emailed me very, very bluntly and just like, hey, so life happens and I'm just going to need you to send me all the money back other than the deposit. You know, I figured you've spent this much of it on supplies, and so just send me the rest back, and a check would be great, and if you could get it to me by Friday. And I kind of flipped on him. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, like, I was like, I can go back to all these emails, and I told you, you can send me money if you want. You don't have to. If you do, I'm putting it in the shop, all this kind of stuff, you know, and it just turned into a whole, you know, shit show. And I was pissed, but I learned a lot from it, you know, particularly like you got to be super, you know, this particular customer, and I don't think he'll listen to this, but maybe he will. Hey, it's like I could tell at the very beginning that this guy was going to be a micromanager, you know, that everything about the build was going to, like, this guy wasn't going to be able to stay away. He wasn't going to be able to let me work. He was going to just every few days have a new idea and double check a concept and he had started, like, he had commissioned this build that I knew was out of my depth. And I told him, I was like, I'd already built him a guitar. And I said, I'm so happy that you have this confidence in me. I'm just telling you straight out, it's going to be a long time before I start this guitar because you're talking about very expensive materials, and I want to be there. I want to be good when I do it. And so that's what we worked under. But he was like, he was itchy. He was both itchy and scratchy about it. He was, he couldn't help himself but to email me every week or two and to just offer a suggestion or question something that we had talked about or send me another PDF with the full spec sheet with pictures of all the guitars that we were supposed to be inspired by and all this. And it, that's fine. You know, that was his personality and I can't begrudge him that.
Yeah.
And I knew he was that guy going into it, but it became too much for me. Where when he said, like, kind of nonchalantly, like, hey, so, you know, I figure this is the easiest way to come up with some quick money. Just send me back most of my money. I just flipped out on him. I was like, I'm not a bank, you know? And I just, I did the whole thing. And and I was pissed, but I learned, you know, I learned an awful lot from it. I'm glad it happened. At the end of the day, you know.
Cool. All right, question four. Name an item from your childhood that you lost or got rid of that you most wish you could get back. Item from your childhood that you wish you still had.
Well, actually, I found out recently that my mom gave all my Calvin and Hobbes books to the middle school that she worked at, which... Oh. Mom, you better replace those.
I'm going to piggyback that, like, with the Bloom County collections.
Oh,
that aren't in print anymore.
They're not.
No, like when I was 7th, 8th grade, like my family and I took a lot of like long drive trips, mm-hmm. like you know between Connecticut and Kansas, and I would read and reread and reread these Bloom County collections.
Oh,
yeah. And they're gone, and as far, you know, maybe they are now, or maybe somebody just pirated the whole thing up to the web and I haven't searched for it, but yeah, that would be the thing, I think, from my childhood that just, like, I still think of those things all the time. I think of, like, because the strips, like, similar to some of the Calvin Hobbes storylines would go on for weeks and weeks, like, that was kind of the MO for Bloom County. It were these long months long storylines, four panels at a time, and each four panel set was gold in and of itself. It was so inspiring. Oh my god.
Yeah, I remember the one where Steve I still have them actually at my house.
Mine
from when I was a kid, but I remember the one where Steve Dallas tried quitting smoking.
Yeah.
And I remember that is when I found that comic strip. And it was like, it was so different from anything else in the paper. Except for maybe Dune Spray, which was also from outer space.
A friend of mine, like, Facebooked that panel from that series with him with the ring ding in his mouth and in his underwear, like, with... Like they said, no, he's, I don't remember what he said, like he's satiated for now, or he's perfectly elegant the way it was said. It was sort of like he's, you know.
Yeah, that was it was so different and I didn't fully understand it, but I think that was one of those things. Bloom County was one of those things that like expanded my consciousness.
Oh, for sure. Because it was political.
Yeah, and it was political and the style of humor was just so different. And
I thought it was like, it was certainly of a piece with Doonesbury, but more surreal and more of its own universe. Like the things that happened were relatable to our universe.
Yeah.
But like they had a, when Opus and Bill the Cat and when they started the metal band, they had the hearings.
Yes, absolutely.
For profanity.
Yes, you know. The PMRC. And I take you had the one that had the a sound disc or the record.
No, I didn't have one with a record.
I had that. I still have that. I still have the record.
So you have, what were they called? Death?
God, it was Heavy Meadow. It was Billy and the Boingers. Billy and the Boingers. I Love You was the A-side.
Name that they replaced.
Yes.
The original name, which was, I said Deathlock, but that's like a, it was Death Something.
Death Something, yeah.
The Basset Hound auditioned with Simon and Garfunkel, but he was wearing like spandex and.
The 80s.
Good times.
Yes. All right. Last one. We're almost through the woods here. Question five. So as much as we've talked about making things and doing things and creating things and all of that, name an artistic skill or talent that you wished you possessed.
I wish I could write. I wish I was a good writer. I think that would be... I guess it's not very exciting to talk about, but
no, that is a thing. I mean, it's a fool's paradise, but
it seems like possibly the most difficult thing to be good at. I don't know. I feel like you could practice drawing forever and get reasonably good at it, or even playing guitar or building anything. But writing, it just seems like you either have it or you don't. Like, there's no.
Well,
I don't know.
I don't know, because I mean, I have from my youth notebook after notebook after. I mean, I would for whatever reason my high school years I didn't sleep or I didn't need to sleep, and it was beautiful. I mean, I would just go to bed or go to my room and just write till 3-4 in the morning. And there was one night a week where I just could stay up 24 hours and didn't. You know, now I mean, now it's like f that. You know, if I don't get my 7 or 8 hours, I'm just like,
I'll get out of it.
You know, yeah. I need to burn them. I mean, they're awful. I mean, it was just like, I would just try everything. I would try plays, I'd try poetry. Actually, I mean, I started writing death metal lyrics. That's how I got into the thing. And, you know, just rhyme everything with T-I-O-N, you know.
Devastation!
You know, it's just, that's it. You know, annihilation. You know, that's all you had to do. But it started, but yeah, they're awful. I mean, it was just hours and hours and hours spent, you know, and I probably have like 8 of them. That I have, and they're locked away. Like, no one can find them.
Bad, find.
Yeah,
don't, writing. Don't is, get into writing.
Yeah, it's it'll ruin your life.
I guess I wish that I not artistic exactly, but I wish I had a little more of that math thing that some artists have. That kind of like serious ability to think. Geometrically and all that kind of stuff, like, because I feel like it might help the guitar building. Yeah. Because you get really like wound up in overall aesthetics and tradition and all these kind of like squishy concepts. Mm-hmm. Like squishy aesthetic concepts. And I kind of wish that I could like make some hard decisions. Mm-hmm. like no, the math doesn't work, the angle has to be this. Mm-hmm. Like, let's serve that, you know. I wish I had more of that. Oh. My wife is an engineer, by training is an engineer, and she's the opposite. Like, she would want to, you know, if she could, she'd just bury all that and just follow the artistic side. But it's like, no, that foundation, you don't even know what you have. Like, you have this kind of really important thing when it comes to making something in 3 dimensions.
Which is, maybe that's also an example of sort of neural pruning, that concept that parts of the brain shut down. Because I know getting my master's in English just pushed the math part out of my brain. Mm. You know, I'm with someone who can do the 20% tip on a check, basically. And I think
society moves you one way or the other.
Yeah.
They're like, you're either that dude, and now we got geek chic and all that, you know. So you can be on the geeky side of things and really be successful and be cool. Yeah. You know, or you're a true artist, you know, where you're not supposed to have any systems or any process or anything.
Yeah, you know? Which is kind of awful.
But I'm certain, I've always been the guy that I appreciate the abstract if I know that the foundation's there. I appreciate the abstract that much more. Cool. And appreciate it on a sensory level anyway. Mm-hmm. But, like, when I know, you know, when you see, Picasso's early stuff, and it's just like, so much cooler that he went where he did.
Yeah.
Because he was so good as a classic, classically speaking.
Yeah.
With music, I'm the same way. It's like, I love a good song, but if I know that those guys can play, like, or could like up and do anything, like, I just like it even more. Cause everything's conscious. Like, you've made all those decisions. You've curated your talent.
Yeah. This is not a happy accident.
It's, right. Yeah. Right. Those are good, too. All right.
Well, I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. And, Google Plus is still a thing, right?
Or
there's a page out there that hasn't been updated for about a year, but it's there, and you should find it and look at it as an archival piece. Thanks to Brett Zork, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later meets.